Artemis II on the cover of Time, and Pandora on the hunt for other worlds. You're listening to Are We There Yet? The radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. The crew of Artemis II is on the latest cover of Time magazine. In the issue, editor-at-large Jeffrey Kluger chronicles how we got to this moment and how this is different than the last time NASA sent humans to the moon, which was more than 50 years ago. Kluger, who has written extensively about NASA's early moon missions, joins us to talk about this moment in history. Then, a new spacecraft is taking a closer look at exoplanets and their atmospheres. The Pandora CubeSat is on a mission to study 20 exoplanets in the next year. Its findings will help other large observatories, like the James Webb Space Telescope, on the hunt for habitable worlds outside our own solar system. Ben Hoard from the Pandora Science Team joins us to bring us up to speed on that mission. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? For the first time in over half a century, NASA is bringing humans back to the moon. The crew of four is made up of NASA astronauts Reid Wiseman, Victor Glover, and Christina Koch, along with Canadian Space Agency astronaut Jeremy Hansen. The Artemis II mission will send that crew on a 10-day trip around the moon and back, which could launch as early as next month. Attempt to launch the mission this month was waved off this week after a rehearsal for launch day uncovered hydrogen leaks and issues with the Orion spacecraft's hatch and ground communications. Still, the four are gracing the cover of Time magazine this month. Jeffrey Kluger has written extensively about NASA's moon programs, and as Time's editor-at-large, he chronicles this mission for the magazine, from the Apollo days to now. And he joins us once again. Jeffrey, welcome back to Are We There Yet?
Thank you so much for having me again.
The piece is a curtain riser as to what's to come with Artemis II, and in it, you interview the four astronauts, the two NASA astronauts, the one from the Canadian Space Agency. Can you tell me a bit about what that was like?
Christina Koch worked in the Antarctic, was at the South Pole Admundson Station for a year. Victor Glover came to us via the USS John F. Kennedy. He flew 400 carrier missions on and off the deck of the Kennedy. Reid Wiseman has had a distinguished career in the Second Iraq War. And Jeremy Hansen comes to us from Canada, from the Canadian Air Force. So, you know, they have very different backgrounds, different personalities, but they've got the same goal and the same ethos and the same enthusiasm about this mission. And they've got a certain humility about it as well. People often say, well, we stand on the shoulders of giants. I once asked Chris Kraft, the legendary director of flight operations at NASA during the Apollo, Gemini, and Mercury era. I once asked him, what is the best crew you ever flew? And he said, this is going to sound like a canned answer, but I always said the best crew I ever flew is whichever one I'm flying today, because they have benefited from all of the experiences of the astronauts who came before them. And I think this crew has the same view of the fact that they are just heirs to the NASA legacy.
You know, in the piece, you mentioned that you asked Commander Reid Wiseman if he understood the immense responsibility and moment that this is. And he jokingly said, well, I didn't until 30 seconds ago. Do you believe that?
Well, I certainly don't want to say they're misrepresenting their thoughts or feelings, but I think it would be very hard to come at this mission and not understand what a landmark it is for humanity. I mean, these folks, you know, I think it's Reid Wiseman who is the oldest of them. He's 50 years old, I believe, which means that none of these crew members were alive the last time we walked on the moon. And I think having been born into a world in which the moon landings were history and having grown up to be the crew that will return us to the vicinity of the moon, you know, that has to carry some historical freight, and it would be hard for me to believe that these folks don't feel that and feel a certain responsibility as well.
I had the chance to interview Christina Koch before she was selected, and one thing that stood out to me is just how passionate she was about these lunar missions, and now she is the one that gets to go to the moon. Tell me a bit about what you gathered from Christina. Who is she as a person?
I think she was always intrepid. She was always an explorer. As she told me when we talked, even as a little girl, she had two great passions, and they were Antarctica and space. So I think she is temperamentally suited for the work she's doing. And, you know, I would go so far as to say she's temperamentally suited to be one of the crew members on whatever lunar base we later established. I mean, she did do long months at a time in isolation with a small handful of other people in forbidding surroundings in Antarctica. She said at one point the temperature outside their habitat was 111 degrees below zero, which is pretty frigid.
You chronicle Victor Glover's journey to this moment. Tell us a bit about how he got to be a pilot of this mission. Right?
He talked a lot about having grown up in challenging circumstances. His mom was a single mother. He talked about living in Los Angeles. He said a pivotal experience for him was when he was 10 years old and was waiting with his mother for a bus in Los Angeles. And it was uncharacteristically cold in Los Angeles. He was not dressed for the weather. He was standing shivering at a bus stop, and he said he thought to himself, when I get out of having to live this way, I will never do it again. He was, as I mentioned, he was a carrier pilot. He ultimately decided military deployments were keeping him away from his family for too long. So when his hitch was up in the Navy, he enlisted in a naval fellowship program, worked for Senator John McCain on Capitol Hill for 9 months, and at the same time submitted his application to NASA, and he went from Capitol Hill to space.
You're listening to Are We There Yet?, the radio show exploring space exploration from Central Florida Public Media. I'm Brendan Byrne. We're speaking with Jeffrey Kluger, editor-at-large at Time, about his story about Artemis II. Jeffrey, there is also one more person on this mission, the Canadian. Jeremy Hansen will be the first Canadian to fly to the moon. What does this show you about the importance of this international collaboration that NASA has in the return to the moon?
You know, 50, 60 years ago, there were two great titanic space powers, the Soviet Union and the U.S., and these were very much mono-national enterprises. It was an American space agency with American astronauts and American engineers flying American hardware, and ditto for the Soviets. Now we have opened up the enterprise of space exploration. Not only is a Canadian, a non-American, flying to the moon for the first time, in 2020 or 21, I believe, the U.S. government established the Artemis Accords, which is an international pact of any member nations who want to participate in the Artemis program, who are interested in contributing money or modules or experiments or astronauts in a collective multinational effort to get to the moon. Portugal just signed on, which makes it the 61st country to become part of the Artemis Accords. When we land on the moon, the thinking is it will happen before the end of the decade, though there are a lot of challenges remaining for that before that goal can be achieved. But when we land on the moon, we will not be planting 61 flags. It will surely just be an American flag once again, but 61 flags will be represented nonetheless. And Jeremy Hansen, participating in this mission, is the first great sign of this international collaboration coming to fruition.
Do you get the sense that this is NASA being overly cautious or not ambitious enough? I mean, if Apollo 8 was able to do it, you know, why is it so difficult to do it again 50 years later?
You ask a good question, and I do believe NASA is not being ambitious enough. We will have proof of whether the service propulsion engine, the main engine of the spacecraft, works. We'll have proof when they fire it to leave Earth orbit and head out to the moon. If the engine is working, there would be no reason to assume that it wouldn't work to get the crew into lunar orbit and wouldn't work to get the crew out of lunar orbit. I believe this is a hurdle that NASA should have sought to clear this time. I do think they're simply being overly cautious. They just want to make sure they get the crew out there and get them back safely. These are very expensive spacecraft they're operating. It costs $22 billion to develop the Orion crew capsule. It cost $25 billion to develop the Space Launch System moon rocket. So I think they, you know, they're being very careful with this hardware. But I think they could have and probably should have thrown the cap over the wall a little further and gone into lunar orbit.
Apollo 8 had such an impact on the general public. It happened in a tumultuous time in U.S. history, but it provided some images that had never been seen before. That moonrise image, the Christmas transmission, you know, during their orbit of the moon. You write in the piece that Apollo 8 saved 1968, and Artemis 2 may work similar magic today. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think there's something transcendent about getting these images from space. I think there's something transcendent about the mere fact that people are going to these places and doing these remarkable things. You know, I often say that I love my country and I consider myself a good American. And, you know, it's my hope that the next boots that are pressed in the moon are worn by an astronaut who has the American flag on the shoulder of the spacesuit. But if that's not to be, if that astronaut has the flag of the People's Republic of China, which is a real possibility, China is very ambitiously pushing a lunar program to get astronauts on the moon's surface by 2030, I will still be thrilled. You know, this will be an emissary of the human species, not just an emissary of the People's Republic of China, if that is what history ordains will happen. I'll be proud to be part of that species. You know, as I say in the piece, I spoke to Michael Collins, the command module pilot for Apollo 11. I spoke to him in 2019 on the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 11 mission. And he said when they went on their global tour after they got back, he said people routinely said to him, "Congratulations, we did it." And he said he had expected people to say, "Congratulations, you did it. You Americans broke out of earthly orbit and landed on the soil of another world." And instead they said, "We did it." And I think that's very much in keeping with how people experience these things. We experience them collectively. When Apollo 8 sent back that Christmas Eve broadcast, it was like there were 3 billion people in the world at the time, and it was like 3 billion people sitting around the same campfire hearing the same story being told. And, you know, I think it'll be that way again.
Do you anticipate that same reception, both here in the U.S. and throughout the world, that this is going to be one of those moments that unifies the entire globe? Or are we so fractured that won't be?
I can answer that two ways. I can answer it the hopeful way and the cynical way. And the cynical way is, you know, you're absolutely right. We are very fractured. And we have a media ecosystem now that didn't exist in the 1960s. At that time, we all watched the same three network news. Now I'm talking about the U.S. As opposed to the world at the moment. But we all watched the same three network news shows. We all read, you know, similar newspapers. And we got a shared view of the world. Now we have our information silos. We can select the kind of information we want to receive. Watching MSNBC is very different from watching Fox News. And we select into those silos, into those belief systems. So it may not work the same magic this time. On the other hand, every time America sends a rover to Mars and the pictures start coming back, I see a flicker of what we felt in 1968. Every time we have an eclipse, I feel a bigger flicker of what we felt in 1968, something wondrous and celestial happening that we're observing. So the hopeful part of me thinks, I believe that it will have a similar effect now. The audience may be a little bit smaller, but for those people who care to engage in the wonder, I think it'll be a really rewarding experience.
Jeffrey Kluger is editor-at-large at Time. Jeffrey, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Still to come, getting a closer look at exoplanets.
We want to understand the atmospheres of these planets. And so the best way that we know of in order to understand what these planetary atmospheres are made of and how they work and where the gases move around is to actually harness the light of the host star.
How a tiny satellite called Pandora is studying planets outside our solar system like never before. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? You're listening to Are We There Yet? From Central Florida Public Media. I'm Brendan Byrne. We're talking about a spacecraft called Pandora. It's a small satellite, but it's embarking on an ambitious mission. Now in low Earth orbit, after launching earlier this year, Pandora will study 20 exoplanets more intensely than ever before. The satellite will study these 20 exoplanets 10 times a year for 24 hours at a time, searching for signs of habitable worlds like water and hydrogen. But how does this tiny spacecraft study distant planets outside our own solar system? Well, here to talk about Pandora and its capabilities is Ben Hoard. He's the deputy lead of science operations and a member of the science team of the Pandora SmallSat mission. Ben, welcome to Are We There Yet?
Thank you for having me.
So we're here to talk about Pandora, a really exciting mission. But first, let's talk about the spacecraft itself, right? Because it's pretty tiny.
It is. It's small but mighty, we like to say. It has a roughly half meter mirror, and it's the size of maybe a mini fridge. And it's right now, as we're talking, orbiting the Earth in low Earth orbit, snapping some pictures of the cosmos. And it's part of NASA's inaugural Pioneers class of missions, which is explicitly meant to send up small spacecraft and balloons in order to answer very specific questions about the universe and fill some of the niches that larger missions can't.
How did it get to low Earth orbit?
The Pandora mission launched aboard a Falcon 9 rocket from Vandenberg Air Force Base on January 11th, and it finally detached from the launch vehicle about 2.5 hours after launch. It went up with a number of other payloads in a sort of ride share, and this was one of the first times that NASA started this type of ride share launch configuration in order to drive down costs, but also get the maximum amount of payloads into space as they can. So we hitched a ride, as if you would call a car, up to the low Earth orbit where we are now.
Well, Ben, now that it is in space, it's going to do the work to answer those big questions that we have about the universe. What is Pandora aimed at getting us an answer to?
So Pandora is going to be looking at least 20 exoplanets and their stellar hosts. So what does this mean? We want to understand the atmospheres of these planets. And so the best way that we know of in order to understand what these planetary atmospheres are made of and how they work and where the gases move around is to actually harness the light of the host star. So when the exoplanet passes in front of the host star, some of the light from the host star actually filters through the atmosphere of the exoplanet before it reaches us. You can think of it kind of like filtering light through a stained glass window. As the light goes through the window or the atmosphere, the color and fingerprint of what it's going through is actually imprinted on the light. So in a stained glass window, we see color. When the light comes through the atmosphere, we see the fingerprints of what the atmosphere is made of. So we can see different types of compounds and elements, and it tells us something about the formation history, something about what it's like on the planet. And so Pandora is specifically searching for these signatures, particularly water, or to determine if an exoplanet is hydrogen-rich in its atmosphere, has clouds, has hazes. And these are all really interesting topics for the scientific community because water, as we know, is a building block of life. Hydrogen, we know of a few gas giants in our solar system that are very hydrogen rich, and they have their own type of formation history and physics. That's the main goal of Pandora, but where it fits into the larger NASA profile is its ability to disentangle that fingerprint of the exoplanet atmosphere from the fingerprint of the host star. We're assuming, naively, take the stained glass window example. When you shine a light through a stained glass window, you assume it's the sun or just a white light bulb, and you see all the colors as they should be. But what if you had a different color of light? You had a red or a green or a mixture of colors of light. You wouldn't get the same color out through the window. And the same thing is happening with the star. As the star's light filters through the planet's atmosphere before it reaches us, and the planet leaves its fingerprint on the light of the star also has its own fingerprint that it started with. So we're kind of looking at two superimposed fingerprints, and it's tough to disentangle which is from the star and which is from the planet. And that's where Pandora comes in. Pandora is specifically geared towards disentangling these two sources of fingerprints in the light that we receive.
You're listening to Are We There Yet? The radio show exploring space exploration. I'm Brendan Byrne. We're speaking with Ben Hoard, deputy lead of science operations and a member of the science team of the Pandora SmallSat mission. Ben, that is fascinating. You've got these two fingerprints coming through, one from the light from the host star, and then the other as it passes through the atmosphere of the exoplanet. Pandora aims to untangle this. How do you do that?
So Pandora is really unique in that it can stare at targets for a very long time, and it also can stare at them in both the visible light and the near-infrared. And so combining these two things is important. The first, long-duration observation is important because we can see how the star changes over time. We think of stars as nice, uniform spheres of light that twinkle out there in the cosmos, but that's not true. Like our sun, most stars have spots or cool patches. Their surfaces are irregular. And so as the star rotates, their brightness goes up and down, and we can see those dark or bright patches come into the field of view and go out of the field of view as the star rotates from our perspective. And so by tracking how the star changes over time, we can actually tease out what the surface of the star looks like. And so combining that with the ability to simultaneously look at these stars and planet systems with visible in the near infrared, we can say, okay, the star is changing this much over time. And so now we're seeing it both in the visible and the near infrared so that we can tell what proportion are bright spots and are dark spots. By actually taking the near infrared spectrum, you can tease out what fraction of the star's surface is covered in the bright spots versus the dark spots versus the nothing, the normal star, and actually learn what that light source is that we're getting filtered through the planet's atmosphere so we can understand it well and remove it entirely from the equation. In order to accurately subtract what the star's contribution is to what we're seeing, we have to know what the star is. That's why it's super important to both get the long-term variation so we know how long the stellar rotation period is and what the surface looks like over time, and but also get that simultaneous visible near-infrared observation to understand what the surface looks like at any particular given time and what the proportion of dark spots versus light spots is.
Has this been done before?
Previously, you would need multiple different observatories looking at the same thing at the same time in order to get that simultaneous visible and near-infrared snapshot. The drawback to that is that you don't necessarily have the long-term monitoring of the star to know how the star has changed over time or what the surface of the star looks like at the time you're looking at it. So you can get simultaneous observations, but you don't necessarily have the context in which to interpret them. You also then have to contend with having two separate observations that may not be able to observe for the full same amount of time, and they're in different places, or they have different systematics that you need to account for. It's tougher. And so having the capability to stare for a long time over the course of a year and take these two data sets, the visible and the near-infrared together on the same observatory is really what's groundbreaking here.
Is the idea or kind of the long-term goal from this to create a catalog of these stars so that when other observatories find exoplanet candidates around these stars, you're able to use your stellar profile to remove that and really get a look at the atmosphere? Is that where this is going?
Oh, well, we have to start small. We're a small mission. So our prime mission is just 20 of these exoplanet targets. It's small by catalog standards. We know of over 7,000 exoplanets at this point. But what it does give us is an understanding of the range of the ways that these stars and planets can behave and help us interpret our other data. So we've specifically chosen stars and planets that span a wide range of stellar brightnesses, stellar temperatures, exoplanet sizes, exoplanet orbital periods, so that we can really dig into how does the star change over the whole parameter space, and what does that mean for observing the planets of all different sizes and orbits. So it's a roadmap, it's waymarkers, but we also intend to try to do some simultaneous observations with other observatories, such as the James Webb Space Telescope. We want to help the James Webb Space Telescope users enhance their data. And so that was particularly where we think Pandora's data is going to be the most useful.
Making these discoveries and these follow-ups, there's a lot of collaboration when it comes to multiple telescopes and observatories and all that. So you're using JWST data for this. You know, how do you see Pandora kind of helping future space-based satellites that are going to be launching, looking for these, like, you know, the Habitable Worlds Observatory or something like that?
The James Webb Space Telescope is a sports car. Extremely engineered, very sophisticated, pushes the cutting edge. But like any good sports car, it has its blind spots. So it's not able to do these long duration stares like Pandora is. It's not able to simultaneously get the full wavelength coverage that Pandora is. Pandora, in a sense, is adding a mirror to that sports car to close that one blind spot. The near-infrared detector on Pandora is actually a flight spare from the James Webb Space Telescope. James Webb is an oak tree. It dropped an acorn, and Pandora was born out of that acorn. The intent from the beginning was to make this Pandora data as relevant to JWST as possible. And the keyword here is context. Pandora provides the context for other observatories' observations. Without this context, you don't really know what your data may be saying. You have a good idea, but you don't know for sure. It's like shaking a gift. When you shake it, you think you hear what's inside, but you don't know what's inside until you open it and you have that context. Like you said, there are future observatories coming up and just other observatories already in existence. And Pandora totally, absolutely intends to help these other observatories by providing that context. And likewise, other observatories support Pandora. Pandora is observing each of these 20 targets 10 times over the course of the year for 24 hours at a time, capturing an exoplanet transit. And some of these planets that Pandora is looking at don't even have 10 atmospheric observations from every other observatory combined.
When are you getting data back?
So right now, Pandora is in its 30-day commissioning period, where we calibrate the telescope, metaphorically turn the lights on and off to make sure the light bulbs are all screwed in correctly. And then we have our year-long worth of prime mission science. One of the other beautiful things about Pandora is that there's no proprietary period for the data. We intend to make all the data public as soon as we can reasonably get it processed. So by mission requirement, we will get our first batch of data released 6 months after launch, but we intend to continue to deliver data to the NASA Exoplanet Archive periodically, kind of as soon as we can get it downloaded, because we really do want this to be a community tool.
Looking forward to it. We've been speaking with Ben Hoard, Deputy Lead of Science Operations and a member of the science team of the Pandora SmallSat mission. Ben, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to the show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Do that on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Stay connected with this show. Be sure to follow us on social media. You can find us on Instagram and Facebook. We're at AWTY Space. And if you got an idea for a future episode of the show, or you want to join us as a guest, reach out. We're at aretheyet@cfpublic.org. Are We There Yet is a production of Central Florida Public Media. Our intern is Orion Boone. Our producer is Marion Summerall. Editorial guidance from LaToya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.